good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Dark Reading Radio. Our episode for today is What Keeps IT Security Professionals Awake at Night? And I'm sure that everyone in the audience has their own opinions about that. But today we're going to get some expert insight. And for today's show, I'm going to pass it over to our community editor and my esteemed colleague, Marilyn Kohotis, to be our host. So, Marilyn, take it away.
Thanks, Sarah, for the introduction, and everyone, welcome to our show on What Keeps IT Security Professionals Awake at Night. As Sarah said, I'm Marilyn Kohotis. I'm the community editor on Dark Reading, and I'm speaking with David Shearer, ISC Squared's Chief Executive Officer, about some of the tough issues facing IT security professionals today, including some results from the just-released 2016 Black Hat Attendee Survey. But first, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, who will be adding his context and comparisons from ISC Squared's Security Workforce Study, ISC Squared co-sponsored Globe Security Spotlight report, and his own very extensive industry experience and the nightmares he has about IT security when he goes to bed. David has more than 30 years of business experience, including being the Chief Operating Officer for ISC Squared, Associate Chief Information Officer for International Technology Services at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Deputy Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of the Interior, and the Executive for Architecture, Engineering, and Technical Services at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. He's been responsible for managing and providing services via international IT infrastructures and has implemented large-scale SAP enterprise resource planning projects, and he has led large geographically separated staffs that support global solutions. At ISC Squared, David is responsible for the overall direction and management of the organization and its Center for Cyber Safety and Education. So with that, welcome, David, and we're very happy to have you as our esteemed guest today.
It's great to be here.
So for our first question, let's talk about what keeps you up at night about IT security.
Well, I kind of separate my worries, if you will, into the company and global perspective. So from a company perspective, I'm more concerned, and what worries me about us becoming complacent. I think there's a tendency in all disciplines to assume that we have the basics down, and I'm always pulsing to see if we're on a continual improvement path. Organizations need to continually assess the maturity and expansion of the security capabilities to meet the programmatic nature of security. And, often my wife will joke to me that, you hear these U.S. football teams and they say, well, why are we losing? And the coach will say, well, you know what? We just got to get back to blocking and tackling. And my wife goes, but haven't they been playing football a long time? Have they forgotten how to block and tackle? And I think that's really, the underlying thing that worries me from an internal standpoint. Have we become complacent? Do we think we're better than we are? Are we continuing to improve? So for example, we preach about patching systems and infrastructure, yet all too frequently the software updates may introduce old or new vulnerabilities. From an internal company standpoint, we actually incur the same type of problems our membership does. And then as an association that certifies and accredits people, we try to advocate on our membership behalf to industry that they need to do a better job of building security. And, the other thing is incident response. I always worry, are we good enough? Can you ever be good enough on incident response? I worry about my staff and their resiliency given, the advanced types of attacks that are always underway. And so, are we evaluating our information assets correctly? Those are things that I worry about internally. But then as an international CEO that has a vision of inspiring a safe and secure cyber world, I have to think about it from a global perspective. So when I get up in the morning and I see these global incidents, a train goes off the tracks, or there's a transportation or critical infrastructure type of thing that maybe haven't been classified as a hacking incident. We may never hear them classified as a hacking incident, but they certainly seem to have the viability of a hacking probe. And I think those of us in the industry, there's that unsaid kind of worry that you know, we know that at some point in time, there could be a major incident that could have life, limb, and property implications. I think that scares all of us. I worry about, you know, the kids that now have technology that almost 24/7/365, and how our research from our Center for Cyber Safety and Education points out that increasingly there are predatory activities online relative to children, seniors as well. They're increasingly, victimized through phishing scams. And I guess, you know, from a global workforce standpoint, I worry about an undersized, overworked, and aging global information security workforce. And these folks, the cavalry's not coming over the hill. The large numbers of people aren't coming to help them with their ever-expanding workforce. And they're getting older. And I worry about their resiliency to continue to fight the good fight, from a global perspective. So those are a few things that I would point out that are on my list of worries. But just a few.
What tranquilizers are you on to help you sleep?
Oh, I tell you, I think it's exhaustion and maybe a little melatonin. But I don't normally need a lot of help.
I could see. Well, I guess you sort of must get used to it. Do you have a strategy to deal with which of these events or issues are, you know, how do you decide to deal with the basics, the resilience, the workforce issues? Do you have a plan, or is it something that you get up every day and say, okay, this is the issue of the day that I'm going to tackle, or is it firefighting all day long?
Well, I think the internal perspective is I would, for a CEO, I would say, you know, hire a fantastic COO, chief operating officer, and have a great executive officer team, whether you're your CFO, your CEO, and general counsel, and entrust that you may be worrying, but that they're looking out for the internal aspects of the corporation. And I'm fortunate to have a really great team that complements me in that regard. I still worry. I think it's just the nature of things because ultimately I'm responsible. But I've got a good team, and so they're continuing to worry about the things I tell them that I worry about and probably adding some of their own to it. I'm more, as the CEO, more outward looking and looking at the industry and globally and what we do and how we better support our members who are out there, you know, trying to fight the good fight with an expanding attack surface, and as people move more and more services to the cloud, and as more mobile devices come in, it just seems like the things that they need to secure and be taking into consideration, that list just continues to expand. And these just aren't 8-hour-a-day jobs. These are jobs that can really test men and women's mettle for resiliency, for sure.
In our Black Hat survey, I thought it was notable that the respondents said that they believed that it wasn't a matter of if, but when their organizations would face a major breach. And in fact, 72% believe it's likely their organizations will face a breach in the next 12 months. And worse, about 70% believe they don't have enough people, budget, or training to defend themselves against current threats. And I just wondered, you know, is that what you're hearing and seeing from the ISC Squared community, the people that are on your team, who you speak with in the industry?
Yeah, I was surprised at the correlation between the Black Hat survey and our Global Information Security Workforce Study. It's good to have that kind of validation, because I think when you do this type of industry research, there's always a sense, are people cooking the books, or what's the sample audience? What are you trying to convey? And we really try to do that. We look at non-member and member compositions in our research, and then when we look at another good survey like this, it just helps us validate that are the findings consistent? And so I saw a lot of consistency. I think the thing there that's changed in the last maybe 2 to 3 years is there's an increasing comfort with recognizing the fact that there's a high probability that any organization is going to be hacked. I don't think we wanted to be open and honest to just fess up to the fact that there's a high probability that a compromise can occur. But I think the healthy aspect of that is what it's done within the industry is it's really turned our attention to our ability to be resilient, our ability to do incident response and restore services and test and cycle through that when an incident does occur, it's our ability to respond to that, our ability, really trying to strive to drive down the time for us to recognize that there's been some type of suspicious activity or a compromise so that we can more readily respond to those types of attacks and restore services and, most importantly, protect information assets within our respective organizations.
Of course, the general public, I think, now is much more attuned to this than they were. Maybe they don't totally understand it at the levels that you do or you're the people that are in information security, but everybody sees a headline every day about something. And do you think that adds to the pressure on information security or gives them more opportunity to get tools in the toolbox and resources to address these problems?
I hope that it raises awareness. A concern that I have, I could add to the list that keeps me up at night, is that the more people hear of these breaches and things in the news, we start to become complacent about it. We just start to accept that this is the norm. I can tell you that constituencies of organizations that are breached, whether it's shareholders, whether it's board of directors, whether it's members and association, they have expectations that the people that are running the organizations are not going to become complacent. But I just hope that the general public, because it's in the news so readily now, we don't start to become, desensitized to it. We see that sometimes in our gaming, and terrorism, the desensitization to loss of life, So we don't want to see such an important thing like information security become desensitized, and we start to say, well, there's nothing we can do. Exactly. So we want to avoid acceptance because that's just not an option. So that's the one side of it. But I do think, I hope that's raising awareness. I think it raises awareness when you hear of CEOs losing their job relative to a breach, or you hear of the amount of money that's involved in recovering from a breach. Some organizations never recovering. Some organizations becoming defunct as a result of a breach. And then just the amount of money in dealing with personally identifiable information aspects of breaches and standing up centers to answer customer information and putting credit reporting in place, and the cost of doing that through a large customer base is significantly it's a significant issue. And then now we've started to broach into the topic of cyber value at risk and starting to talk about cyber insurance and how much insurance do organizations need to have to protect themselves in the event of a breach. So I think those are healthy developments, because as we see these things are out there, it's no longer, I think, perceived that somebody's just making this up. We're trying to lead through fear, uncertainty, and doubt. We are now seeing that this is affecting organizations in a whole series of ways.
Right. Let's look a little bit in the rearview mirror. I want to go back to the Black Hat survey, and I thought this number was pretty astonishing, that almost 60% of respondents have experienced breaches through phishing or malware in the past year. Are you surprised by that high percentage, or is that what you're seeing too?
No, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at that. The phishing type of the degrees to which phishing has become an attack strategy and scams or so forth, I think we're all seeing that has just surged in the last 2 to 3 years. That's why when I look at senior citizens, for example, children not as to a degree, when we look at how we try to educate them on how to be safe and secure online, seniors, you know, we look at our parents and seniors that we know, and we think of telemarketers calling them on the phone and trying to use, you know, a language to scam them out of money. Or now you see these emails that look very, very real to them that might be saying, hey, the bank needs you to change your password, you know, these types of things. And if these folks are not educated on don't click on that link or be very careful, call the bank, you can just see the orders of magnitudes of vulnerability out there within various vulnerable sectors of our populations. So I'm not surprised at that. And of course, the malware is, you know, that has always been, you know, in the top five and many times in the top three major concerns. And you know, it still remains.
With the phishing, I mean, I've seen stories and read things where, you know, CEOs get fooled by phishing. They're so sophisticated now. So it's not, senior citizens are indeed vulnerable, but you know, we all are actually.
I mean, I could add that to my list too. Another fear I have is that I actually get scammed on a phishing, you know, as the CEO of a security firm, that, you know, that I would be someone that would get caught up in it. I think all CEOs, you know, we've seen some of that in the news in the last 3 to 4 months, that, you know, some of the most senior CEOs on the planet and leading technical firms can find themselves victims. So, you know, you have to be extremely cautious.
The other data point that came out in the Black Hat survey was that 23% of respondents experienced a ransomware attack in the past year, and 17% identified a targeted attack. Now, you think, is a ransomware, is that square with what you're seeing? I would think that would have been higher, but maybe it was just the audience, the sample that we were talking about.
I think within survey instruments, the ransomware question is a more recent question. So I don't think we have necessarily seen the trend data to see that, like, over the last 5 years. And so as I start to see the respondents or the responses to various survey instruments, that's a new kind of area that I'm tracking and trying to, you know, crosswalk to see where it seems to be in the number, because, you know, just to see how bad and how pervasive that actually is. I think, like other types of compromises, you know, the disclosure of those types of attacks may be slow to be starting to come, and we may see, to your point, that it's actually happening far more frequently. But if you're in the middle of a ransomware type of situation where you might actually be in negotiations over that, or you know, there may be sensitivity in even reporting out or having attribution associated to that type of compromise, we may be seeing underreporting. So I don't feel like I have enough data, as I look at it from an industry leader, to have a real strong opinion on whether those seem to look right. Because I don't know that as an industry we really have enough information yet to know the orders of magnitude of how pervasive that type of attack is.
It's definitely a hot button, though. I know, I can, just from our readership, what they respond to and what we publish. We can't publish enough about ransomware. Our audience seems to just eat it up because it's such a vexing problem.
Well, I mean, certainly when you hear of hospitals and you know, I mean, when you start to think of hospitals or services that might have, you know, like I said, life, limb, and property type of implications, you know, if you hear of it, we've heard of some of this in some of the medical organizations, you know, you could see this starting to you know, pivot off to early responders, law enforcement, this type of thing. And when you start to think of they need specific data to perform their function that could have put lives at risk, it becomes increasingly concerning.
Yeah, that's a good point. So let's move a little bit to a different area and talk about the cloud. In the Black Hat survey, almost half, 40% of respondents said that enterprises are concerned about accidental data leaks from the cloud, and 46% from infected end-user devices. And then in the 2016 cloud survey that ISC Squared co-sponsored, security concerns topped the list of barriers to cloud adoption, led by general security concerns, 53% up from 45% in last year's survey. Yet, in my interpretation, the survey suggests that the rise in specific concerns about compliance and integration means that companies are moving from theoretical exploration, or this is what the survey said, of cloud models to actual implementation. So if that's the case, what are some of the practical security issues that cloud adopters are grappling with, and what, are they finding any solutions?
Well, I think the challenge that we have from a business standpoint is that there's such an attractiveness to the price point of moving from on-premise solutions to cloud-based solutions. We find that as companies, because our core competency isn't always necessarily IT and data centers, that cloud providers can really have very competitive price point. And so when you're looking at your operating cost, you know, and moving from a capital expenditure to an operating expenditure model, there's a big push to do that. And then you got CIOs and CTOs and chief information security officers. They're all caught up in saying, okay, we're not going to be able to stop this train, but how do we do this in a secure way? How do we fashion contracts so that we know that there are appropriate protective clauses in there for if we want to back out from this cloud provider, that our data, you know, how do we back our data out? How do we know that when we leave, our data is expunged? How do we know what constitutes an incident on behalf of the cloud provider? Because, you know, maybe you're in a multi-tenancy, or for folks that aren't familiar with that term, it's like you're sharing infrastructure. And so if an incident occurs within that infrastructure for another customer, should you be notified? Working through how you fashion the contract in a cloud environment is really the first starting point to give you some assurances. And then looking at what type of security provisions and ongoing security assessments that provider has in place. It's really, you have to think of it as you're extending yourself into these cloud providers' data centers. And so everything that you've done to secure on-premise, you have to think of it in the context of having this business partner that's your cloud provider. And then I think the thing that really, I think really has the potential to throw the cloud industry on its ear, and we're advocates of cloud, but it's just as you start to look at the GDPR, and data sovereignty, international data sovereignty issues that say that if you live in the UK and you're a citizen, your data should not leave that country. So now we start to see that, you know, how our cloud providers, it's a bit paradoxical, because it's unlikely that companies are going to be able to stand up data centers in every country where they do business. So it almost pushes them towards cloud. Now it is, how are the cloud providers going to be able to offer assurances that data sovereignty is going to take place if you do business with them in company A, B, C, et cetera? And so data sovereignty is a huge issue that is, you know, we're maybe 3-4 months into that provision, at least within the EU, and we're going to need solutions in fairly short order. So there's a push to put it there. How do we do secure interfaces? How do we ensure that access control is appropriately provided for? You know, you have encryption issues in data in transit, data in rest. But the thing is that if you do this in a very pragmatic way, to the counter of all those concerns is that there are some people that could potentially be even more secure by moving to the cloud, because they don't have the mature, repeatable processes and discipline of physical security, access security. They may be in dated data centers. Some people have their servers sitting in a closet on the floor that's not locked.
Right.
So some people say, "I fear the cloud." I go, "Well, maybe you should be fearing your on-premise solution, because fear your closet more." Exactly. So I think that, you know, what we advocate is that, you know, moving to the cloud is inevitable. And so what you have to do is you just have to look at it in a very pragmatic way. And I think if you follow it very methodically, you can do it as securely as you probably can, with that understanding of what we said earlier. We can't guarantee there will not be a breach. But so the same thing happens, and you have to work with that cloud provider in an incident. What is their role? What is your role? What are the notifications that both sides give? Because you could have a breach within your on-prem solution that now that connection into that data center may provide a pivot point for someone to compromise your cloud provider, and vice versa. So you're joined at the hip, and you really need to understand contractually who's responsible for what service level agreements are in place, and understanding that if, in fact, you want to move away from that cloud provider, how do you successfully back out of that arrangement and ensure that your information assets are protected throughout and that, you know, they're expunged correctly after you're gone, if that's what you elect to do. You don't want to get yourself into lock-in where you move to a cloud provider and you don't have options.
It sounds to me from what you're saying that there's a challenge in terms of both getting the technology right and getting the business part of it right, which is not a natural thing for most people that work in information security today to have that business sense. So I guess that's a segue. That's a question that you can answer about cloud, and it will help us. We can then segue in our last few minutes on the live part of the audio part of the program. We can move a little bit into talking about security skills shortage, and then we'll move on to the chat part. So I guess let's talk about the cloud skills, technical versus business, and then the general skills shortage after that.
Well, I think your question was along the lines of, you know, how do we start to take our information security workforce and make them more business savvy relative to their value add to, you know, business enablement as opposed to a cost center that, you know, people perceive that we're spending money on security, yet we can't guarantee security. And I think a lot of that comes down to, I think one of the common things that the business community in an organization and the CISOs and CIOs and CTOs have to deal with, it's this concept of how do we ensure our organization relative to a potential breach? And if the more mature we are and the less probability we will have a breach, while we can't guarantee, but we can drive up our resiliency capability and therefore drive down our risk and hopefully drive down our operating costs relative to the level of cyber insurance we would have to cover. Now we start to have a value at risk, a risk discussion that's a business conversation. We're not talking the routers and the firewalls and kind of the techno-babble discussion. We're talking business terms of how information security, cybersecurity is actually an enabler to the business. And so what we're trying to do in our conferences and in our outreaches is have more business discussions within our membership to position them to be able to articulate the value proposition of cyber and information security. And so there's still work to be done there. So I think that was the first part of your question, Marilyn.
Yes.
What the second part was, just to refresh?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the security skills shortage. And so we can jump off with a data point from the Black Hat survey that said 74% of respondents say they don't have enough staff to defend their organizations against threats. And not only that, but the pool of available talent is shrinking, not growing. Where do you see the big problems in the security skills area, and, you know, where are the solutions?
Well, there's the skills, and then where are we getting? I'll just offer a couple data points from our Global Information Security Workforce study. So that study is just under 15,000, or actually under just under 13,930 respondents. So pretty large sample set. The average age in that sample set is 42 years of age. Okay, not so old, but not so young. The average number, the percentage of people in that pool that are below the age of 30 is 6%. And so what we see is when I say I'm concerned about an aging workforce, not that I think that 42-year-old folks are falling over, but I'll tell you what, when we're running them 12, 14 hours a day defending their organization, I don't care how young or old you are, that takes a toll. But we have this influx of trying to reach the next generation, the young folks coming into the industry. You know, that survey tells us that with 6% below the age of 30, we're just not reaching folks. And I don't think we're reaching folks in the engineering disciplines, all of which that play a role in security, because whether you're mechanical, electrical, software, chemical engineer, you're developing products, or the likelihood of you developing products that have security implications is very high. And so we need to be reaching out to the engineering disciplines. We need to be reaching out to kids in high school. We attempt to do that through our Safe and Secure Online program, that when we're talking to young children about how they can be safe online, you know, making the pitch to them that, you know, cyber and information security, this is a demanding career path and something that they should consider. But a lot of it has to do with messaging. You know, we just don't seem to be messaging correctly to be attracting people into the field. And so at IC Squared, we continue to grapple with that and look for ways to improve that. But I think as an industry at large, we have a messaging problem.
We haven't had any successes with messaging that you can share? What are you still grappling with the question?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is that even with when you try to get something that resonates with somebody, certainly a young individual that may be looking at a career path, you know, we now have Garfield as our spokescap for children. So we think we're going to hold their attention in the discussion of being safe and secure online, and through that, raising their awareness that this technology that they've had since they've been 2, 3, 4, I mean, you see young kids walking around, children walking around, almost seems like babies walking around, smartphones and mobile devices. I mean, from as far back as they can remember, they have technology in front of them. But if you can find a fun way that resonates with them, it says, look, this is fun technology. It can be very fun, but there are aspects of it that you have to be aware of. And you know, if you look at Garfield trying to lead that conversation and his friends, maybe we can make it fun and they can see that, yes, you know, you could be one of Garfield's deputies and starting to study for cybersecurity and try to get them interested young. And then, you know, other things that we're doing through our associate program allows us to reach people that don't have the experience level required to hold one of our certifications. They can pass an exam, and we can start to get them into these entry-level positions if an employer gives them that chance, knowing that they've passed a rigorous exam. Once they get their experience, they'll be on their way to full certification. So there's a series of things that we're doing to try to create on-ramps for people that otherwise might not be able to come into the profession or think that they can, and then reach the young that are coming up through the ranks. And then we have aspirations of developing secondary school-level curriculum to try to have curriculum there that creates a funnel for kids to come into the profession. So there's a lot there to be done, and we're not the only ones in the game getting things done, but I think as an industry, we have to just recognize that we have a dearth of talent, especially at those entry-level positions. What's that next wave of where are they coming from? And then we have to look at diversity within those ranks as well. I mean, women still only make up 8 or 10% globally of the workforce. And so why are we missing that? Is that a messaging issue too? Are there things we can do there? And that's just one demographic. I mean, you look at other underrepresented minority groups, and that really takes almost a regional type of perspective. And so this year in our Global Information Security Workforce Study, we're asking some of those minority types of questions so that we can start to try to tease out, where are we seeing underrepresented groups, and what can we do to go to those types of colleges and universities and maybe help them develop curriculum and try to draw from all the wells of talent to try to address the dearth of talent that we see to the tune of 1.5 million by 2020. And here we are sitting, you know, in 2016, we're burning daylight between when the study came out and then 2020, and the numbers don't seem to be reflecting that we're making significant progress.
It's remarkable to me that there aren't more people, millennials, that are flocking to these jobs because they pay well compared to what other opportunities there are in the marketplace. And is it because they don't have the training, they don't know how to go, they don't fit into the organizations when they're hired, that the employers don't know where to find people that have maybe the innate talent but don't have the educational background or the know-how to take a test or get certified?
You know, Marilyn, all those questions, if I knew which one of those things was it that I could put my finger on, but those are all, you know, those are all kind of great data points. Is this what's driving? Is that, I don't know that we know definitively. You know, we all kind of speculate on what it might be. And I think to a degree, and this has a ripple effect through all of it. It has a ripple effect. This is my theory, one of my theories, right? So you know, the theory of one bald guy. So just take it for what it's worth. I think that cybersecurity, information security, isn't seen as being cool. It's not seen as being cool from a business standpoint sometimes because the business side sees it as a cost center and they don't see how it is business enablement because there tends to be more no's, you know, that we tend to be seen as the side of the organization that says no instead of the side of the organization that makes the organization go. And so we need to really start to bridge the gap there to show that information security it's just fundamental to how we do business today. It needs to be baked into everything we do, and it's an enablement. And so when you see, I think young folks that see, they look at information security and cybersecurity as almost the cops of the web, right? And,
right.
And you know, they like their devices to be open, unfettered, and sometimes I think what they perceive the job entails, I think they see it counter to perhaps that kind of free flow of ideas and openness that they've grown up with, that they've come to enjoy. And that's the dynamic, that's the paradox that we in the industry struggle with, right? How do we make it secure yet still make it usable? How do we you know, not encumber it so much that we take great technology that has great convenience and dummy it down so much through all the security provisions we have to take that the people that are using it to do their jobs are no longer interested, or they don't perceive you as doing anything to enhance their ability to perform their job or live their lives?
It's a big challenge. I don't know. I live in the Boston area, and GE just moved its corporate headquarters here. And part of the reason was because there's a great pool of talent in the Boston area, and the commercials that I've seen on TV for advertising coding and those kinds of jobs for sort of an old industry like GE are hysterical. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not a millennial, well, far from it, but I would think that would, you know, something like that would get people to, you know, interested in those types of careers, and be interesting to see how they do in their hiring. But anyway, I think we're way beyond the time that we're supposed to be going on to the live chat, the chat on the site. So I see a few questions there. So, if Sarah, are you still there? Should we move over to
I'm still here, and yes, we should. That was a great conversation, Marilyn and David. Thank you so much. For those of you who are joining us live, as Marilyn said, we are now moving on over to the live text chat, which is on the Dark Reading site where you are obviously listening to us. And you should be listening to us live because you will get to participate in this great online text chat where the first question that I'm going to ask is how they came to the decision to use Garfield as the spokescat, just because I really love the word spokescat, so I'm really excited to learn more about that. If you can't listen to us live, obviously you can listen to all episodes of Dark Reading Radio archived. They are archived just about 5 minutes after we end, so that's a great way of catching up on all the episodes of Dark Reading Radio that you miss. But come back again next month. We'll have another great episode waiting for you then. Until next time, for Marilyn Cohodes and everybody at Dark Reading Radio, and, of course, thank you again to our excellent guest, David Shearer, ISU Squared's Chief Executive Officer. Thanks to all of you. We will see you again next time.